Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is Here and Now. On this Thanksgiving Day, we welcome our friends at the weekly podcast Backstory to talk about a very appropriate topic, the history of stuffing. Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers are historians and co-hosts of Backstory. Welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Good to be here.
Now, I think there may have been a breakdown in communication. I thought that we were going to be talking about stuffing recipes for Thanksgiving, but no, you are here to talk about the history of taxidermy in America, a very different kind of stuffing.
And yet it is stuffing, right? We can agree on that, right?
So what have you got for us about that?
Well, it's a pretty amazing story, actually. Let's think about there's a painting that people may have seen by Charles Wilson Peale, and he's showing you his museum, actually, there in Boston. And it's a self-portrait. And he's an older guy, and he pulls back the curtain, gazes right into your eyes, and shows you what's in his museum. And what it is a stuffed American eagle, and on the floor, an American turkey awaiting to be stuffed in a taxidermy type. But it turns out that he had bigger ambitions for his taxidermy than just these birds. He wrote to a group of civic leaders that he invited to serve on a committee of directors for his museum. And this pretty impressive board had people, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, you may have heard of. But I don't think they'd ever seen a proposal quite like the one he put before him.
What do you mean?
Well, he proposed that it would be a great idea to stuff people like, say, Ben Franklin.
What?
And by implication, themselves.
Some people felt he already was stuffed, Ed. That's the thing. He would be double stuffed.
He was the opposite of stuffy, Brian. And so his idea would be, you know, these guys are so great. Wouldn't it be wonderful if subsequent generations could cast their eyes upon their greatness, looking the way that they really do? And he says there's this new form that he's actually a pioneer in of using arsenic to be able to keep animals almost indefinitely. So he thought, well, if it was great for stuffing birds, wouldn't it be great for stuffing luminaries? So he was regretting that he forgot to mention this to Ben Franklin before he died. But fortunately, he had these guys before him and thought maybe they'd be interested. They weren't.
You know, these days they do this with like holograms of people. It seems a little less morbid than actually stuffing the person, but good thing for consent. Otherwise, we'd be looking at all the founding fathers, stuffed in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, Peale unfortunately had to settle for stuffing Franklin's Angora cat and a couple of golden pheasants that belonged to George Washington.
What a letdown.
So it sounds like a weird idea, but it turns out that other people have had the same idea. If you go to Russia, you can see Lenin, or you can go to Vietnam and see Ho Chi Minh, or China and see Chairman Mao, and they're all on display and stuffed. And you could argue that going to Madame Tussauds' life-size waxworks is kind of a similar thing. But the real inspiration for Peale was an English philosopher, Jerry Bentham, whose preserved body, and this just sounds like a great idea, is wheeled out for committee meetings at University College London.
My God.
Wouldn't that give a certain air of gravity to your deliberation?
That just makes no sense at all. But isn't most taxidermy about, like, an elk or a deer or something like that, or a bear?
Yes, or a bird. Maybe even a bird that's a literary character.
Who are you talking about?
Well, just listen up. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as someone gently rapping at my chamber door. 'Tis some visitor, Jeremy, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more. All right.
Okay.
Right. So what kind of bird would that be?
Are we talking about a raven, perhaps?
You are on fire.
500 points for Jeremy.
You are on fire. Well, that raven, the actual raven that inspired that poetry or novel, as it may be, is sitting stuffed on a log in the rare books department
really?
Of the Philadelphia Free Library.
The exact raven.
Now, here's the thing. You're not going to believe this, Jeremy, but that raven was really Charles Dickens' raven. Huh. And I mean that quite literally. Dickens wrote a novel called Barnaby Rudge, and the novel featured his pet raven, Grip, right? Poe gets involved in this story because Poe wrote a review of Barnaby Rudge, and he kind of liked it, but he said, you know, Dickens could have done a lot more with that raven. And wouldn't you know it, that Edgar Allan Poe did. So he wrote The Raven. The Raven became very famous, but the raven was no longer alive. The raven suffered a terrible fate, and Dickens was so attached to that raven that when the raven died, he had an autopsy performed. I'm not making this up. It was probably lead chips and lead paint poisoning that did in the raven. So anyway, the raven is shuttled off. He wasn't just napping. And the raven is finally auctioned off in the 20th century. And he makes the rounds and he ends up in Philadelphia, in the Free Library of Philadelphia, in the rare book, or we really should call it the Rare Raven Room.
You know, we humans really are just incapable of saying goodbye to things that we... It's really... What other historic animals have been preserved, by the way, while we're talking about this?
Well, you know, a raven's pretty impressive, and that's quite the literary legacy, but I've got something much larger.
Oh, always one
yeah,
up.
Yeah, well, a horse, and not just any horse, but the horse of General Stonewall Jackson of the Confederacy. And what's interesting about this horse is that he outlived his owner by 30 years and became a celebrity across the South. They'd take him around at reunions and things, and people loved Little Sorrel was his name. He wasn't actually that little, but that was in comparison to Big Sorrel that Jackson had owned. And so he lives out a great life for 30 years, and the latter years goes to the old soldiers' home in Richmond, Virginia, where the Confederate veterans help take care of him until he dies. And when he does die, he's so beloved that they get the leading taxidermist in the country from the North to come down and figure out how you might preserve Little Sorrel forever. They decide that rather than stuffing him, and I hope you'll allow me to still work this into our stuffing show, Jeremy, they put him on a plaster base. So we kind of suspend the horse's hide over this. And so it looks very realistic. And if you don't believe me, you can go to the Virginia Military Institute Museum and see it for yourself today.
Okay, so with all of this crazy history that I had never even thought of,
right?
Why do people like to stuff animals so much?
Well, I think there's a longer story here about men, and it's usually men exerting dominion over nature. It's certainly very much an American story, taming nature. And in the case of stuffing animals and the United States, it's really very much about fairly wealthy Easterners going out west, shooting these animals for sport and for fun, but also doing good at the same time by bringing them back, stuffing them, and what better than using them for educational purposes, which they did in these things called dioramas. And I'll bet you've been to one, Jeremy. I mean, I went to them as a kid. There's, you know, you've got the jungle or the forest, and there's the lion peeking out there. It's usually a darkened room, and they actually can be quite frightening to a kid. But the purpose of these dioramas at the beginning of the 20th century, like the Museum of Natural History, was to educate. So these wealthy men, think Teddy Roosevelt, for instance, go out. They're big game hunters. They shoot, they kill, but they also feel they're doing good by conserving and bringing back nature in its, quote, pristine form.
And today, taxidermy has another form. There's a sort of a new rage for taxidermy.
Really?
Yeah, there is. There's classes that you can take in most of the major cities of the country. And, you know, it's the journalistic approach to his hipster taxidermy.
Yeah, you have to have a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer in order
right.
to participate.
But the idea is that they don't kill any animal for this purpose. And they pride themselves in the artistic and creative setting of them. And sometimes doing things like, you know, putting horns on a small rodent, things like that.
Who wouldn't do that?
Exactly. So what it suggests is that, you know, humans and animals have this strange relationship that can take lots of different forms, and it's still taking new forms even today.
And if you want to be right on the cutting edge of the taxidermy revolution, buy in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. That is the new hot hipster center of taxidermy. Thanks to both of you, Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast, Backstory. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks very much.
You
don't
too.
Get stuff.
And pass the cranberry sauce.
Okay, keep them coming. And if you want to see some pictures of Grip and Little Sorrel, visit us on the web at hereandnow.org. And here's another historical note. The inventor of the green bean casserole was Dorcas Riley, who came up with the idea in 1955 while she was working at Campbell Soup Company. Campbell estimates the green bean casserole will be eaten in more than 20 million homes today. Dorcas Riley passed away last month at the age of 92, and this afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll remember her life and her contributions to this holiday. You're listening to Here and Now.